ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Splendour in the Grass Festival was cancelled this year. Mona Foma has called it quits. And the federal government has launched an inquiry into live music in Australia. At the local level, many venues are saying, that's great, but we might not be able to survive until that inquiry is finished. And local artists don't seem to be earning any more than they were decades ago, so it's not them driving up costs. Why is live music struggling so much when around a third of Australians apparently are still keen to go to gigs? Dr. Ben Green is a research fellow at the Griffith University Centre for Social and Cultural Research. Ben, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Great to have you here. And Charles Jenkins is an Australian musician with more than 20 albums to his name. The latest is Radio Sketches the Third, and he teaches music too at the Box Hill Institute in Melbourne. Charles, hi.
Hi, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Ben Green, before we look at local level music, what's going on with the big festivals? Is this just a kind of cycle of renewal, people step back and reassess and re-emerge, or is there something bigger going on?
Well, there have always been ups and downs in this sector. About 10 years ago, there was talk of a bubble bursting, partly because the festival sector was growing so much and there was so much competition happening. But what we're seeing now is a real confluence of factors, a bit of a perfect storm, that in the end, what they add up to is increased costs of putting on an event and decreased demand with things like the cost of living crisis. And there's a number of factors that feed into that ultimate equation. And I would suggest it is something of a unique moment, given all these global and social society-wide issues like climate change, like economic crisis, like technological change, and so forth, all of these things combining to create what we call a deep uncertainty, which is not just your usual conditions of the market, but something beyond that that really challenges the fundamentals of being able to have a sustainable live music sector, including festivals.
Well, it's interesting to see how the announcements differ, I guess. David Walsh from Mona said, look, it's just costing me a lot to run Mona, so maybe I'll focus on that for a while. But that deep uncertainty is fascinating. You're saying it's a kind of a generalised anxiety level about the unknown unknowns in the world that might affect music festivals.
That's exactly right. We're used to uncertainty in any form of business and in what we call cultural production, putting on events. Of course, there's uncertainty. No one knows what'll be number one next week, let alone what'll be popular with audiences in a year's time, which is the sort of time frame a festival operates on, and venues operate months in advance as well. So there's no accounting for taste. And everything in this sector, all of the returns for the people in business and all of the benefits, the broader benefits for society, all hinge on a certain event happening in a certain time and place in the expected way. Even though, of course, spontaneity is a big part of live music, you need that fundamental reliability. And that's what's actually challenged at the moment. That's why I think the theme that sums up all of these other challenges is this uncertainty that goes beyond the typical uncertainty that, you know, the sector is set up to deal with.
Yep. I imagine natural disasters might play on the consumer's mind too. What about the local venue level, Ben? Are they dealing with the same problems just at a different scale?
In some ways, it's the same issues. Ultimately, you've got the equation of what it costs to run the venture versus the returns that you get. And with venues just like festivals, even at the small venue scale, there are some of the same factors. You've got consumers facing a cost of living crisis, and especially young people we know are tightening their spending, their discretionary and entertainment spending. And the costs of running things include an insurance crisis for this whole live events sector. In some cases, hundreds of percent, up to an 800% increase in insurance premiums over the last few years since the COVID pandemic. And that's actually a major factor for a lot of these businesses. But of course, venues have some slightly different concerns. We're used to the fact that venues are located in often in cities or urban environments where their uses might come into conflict with other uses like residential developments. But increasingly, the issues they're facing aren't from regulation, It's simply the market, including the real estate market, is really becoming an issue for venues. The cost of having that piece of real estate in the sort of location that people can access to attend live music events.
We're speaking with Dr. Ben Green, who's a research fellow at the Griffith Centre for Social and Cultural Research. And with us too is Charles Jenkins, who's an Australian musician of many decades standing. Charles, what's it like from the musician's point of view in this country? Are you all, you know, on massive riders, living it up, jetting around?
Yes, exactly correct. It's not quite like that. And it does sound quite grim when it's presented the way that Ben has presented it. But we also need to, I think, look at the fact that there are so many festivals in Australia and there are so many live gigs in Melbourne. Like per capita in Australia, there's more festivals than there is in the UK. There are so many gigs in inner Melbourne. So, yes, these things will eventually, unfortunately, at some point, venues won't be able to sustain themselves. And as Ben pointed out, it seems the insurance aspect is really the thing the government should step in on. But from a live point of view, for the musician just starting out or at whatever stage of their career they're in, there, you know, the good news is there is still that desire from the public to experience songs, to kind of enjoy, you know, the stories being passed and enjoy the atmosphere and the rhythm and the melody and the harmony. So the good news is if like the audience will always be there, I'm kind of going out on a limb here, but I feel that because of the human condition, the way that, you know, as a species we have evolved, we still desire those things that the songs can present.
Really interesting text just popped in, Charles, about that. So Splendour in the Grass and such large festivals are full of drugs to keep fans going for the duration. It's epidemic, says Carol. And she says, I, for one, am happy they're having viability issues. Smaller, more intimate music could be the way. I mean, that's one perspective. But, I mean, some of the smaller festivals still do okay, don't they, Charles? I'm thinking of the Port Fairy Folk Festival. What do you think that is?
Well, the Port Fairy Folk Festival, which I was just played it, and it's great. It was packed. It was able to put up with the adverse heat weather conditions. I think there's a number of factors there. One, it's really well curated, the acts that are chosen. Two, it's so well organised to be able to kind of cope with anything that takes place weather-wise. The interesting thing for me also is that it's attached to the town. So Port Fairy or Queenscliff, and I'm sure there's many other festivals around the country, being attached to a town kind of gives the punter the opportunity to kind of, you know, just step away from the tent scene and go into a nice little intimate venue, a bookshop or a church or what have you, a little theatre, and to still have that wonderful musical experience. But maybe it's, you know, they're enjoying that intimacy that they might not get in a large one kind of stage festival event, and they're enjoying maybe being out of the elements momentarily.
Yep. I was thinking too about the change in the kind of ecosystem of touring, Charles. When streaming started to get bigger and began to strip away the income from album sales, we often heard that artists would make up the difference through touring. Is that still something that's a viable option for performers in Australia?
It is to a certain level. I mean, you have to get to that level first, and streaming hasn't helped anyone, any young musician kind of get off, you know, get their foot on that first rung of the ladder. You just need to be creative and at all levels of this thing, like creative in the way that you do your merchandise. I'm not sure whether because of streaming then people balk at paying to go and see a band. I'm not really asking the right person for that, but I still think that the, you know, people do want that thing that they can take away from the performance. And it's up to the songwriter, it's up to the band to kind of give them the performance that the audience can participate in. And I can assure you that if you get the audience to sing along, if you get the audience to join them rhythmically or whatever it may be, I mean, they will come to your merch desk and they will throw their money at you.
That's very comforting. I imagine lots of younger artists are lapping that up, Charles Jenkins. What about the pay from a gig? How does that compare today, Charles, to, say, what you were seeing a decade or so ago?
Well, it's always been dreadful. It's always I've never kind of played that type of that type of music that I think the genre is called successful. So I'm not exactly sure how. I mean, it was never good to begin with. I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, when I first started making music, you'd have to play gigs for 6 months to be able to get enough money to go into the recording studio to blow it in 2 days' time whilst trying to find a snare drum sound or something. So, but these days you can make your music at home on your computer, more or less, and then sell your music or stream it, what have you, on the computer as well. So there's benefits and there's gains and there's losses in this current situation. Again, if you just persist with the song itself and persist in making sure that you're in a band or a solo performer that can really put these songs across, then I really do sincerely believe that the people will come.
Lots of interesting texts coming in on this issue of, you know, how important live music is for us as a society and also how to support it. Small venues often rely on festivals too, says one text. Taking on popular sideshows generates revenue for them. Another says pokies have all but killed small live music venues. There are hardly any venues left for upcoming bands to learn their craft. And a follow-on to that, another text, they killed off the live music scene in Sydney by bringing in new fire regulations. So it just made it cheaper to put in pokies than to upgrade the venues. And Margaret says, the first proper rock concert for me was, yes, at the Horden Pavilion in 1973. Unforgettable, she says. Music is therapeutic for people to find their own tribe. Dr. Ben Green, it was interesting to see announced today that Triple J are bringing back the One Night Stand series after a hiatus, bringing Australian music for one day to one regional town in 2024. What's the regional Australian music scene like? Because there used to be, you know, small but quite healthy scenes outside the major cities. Are we seeing this kind of vulnerability of live music across the board?
Well, there is great interest and great activity in regional music. And that's one of the first things to highlight, because often there's a metropolitan bias in the discussions around live music and including in the policy around live music. So the first thing to recognise is, yes, there are music scenes in regional areas, and we know from research that they have outsized benefits, economic benefits and cultural and social benefits for the places where they happen. But the range of challenges faced are different. It's not necessarily about noise complaints or real estate prices and gentrification of inner cities. There are also issues of sheer distance and costs being major issues in regional places and connecting places. And that's one of the big changes from perhaps some of the peak regional touring days of the 1980s, is that those regional touring circuits that used to be just part of the calendar for a lot of working musicians aren't really there now. But I see in my discussions with both venues and local communities and the musicians that might be touring around, there is a desire for that to be there. And so there are various steps that need to be worked on for that to be built up, but the demand is there.
Why should we care, Ben? I mean, there's a lot of people saying, look, I love music and I love going to festivals, but tell us about some of those broader cultural and social benefits that you see through your work.
Sure. Well, with live music, one of the ways that things get measured and has started only fairly recently to be measured is through the dollar value. So economists have put together reports that have been accepted by our governments in really only in recent years, putting forward what's called the gross value added for live music, meaning how to put a price on not just the immediate returns, but all of the other industries and jobs that depend on live music happening in particular areas, and the mental health benefits and the social cohesion. And of course, those things contribute to productivity, as they say, which, sure, that's important. And they put it up around $6 billion nationally and tens of thousands of jobs. But to me, what's equally as important is that that's a part of what makes life worth living. It's a part of our cultural fabric. As you said, we've got about a third of the population attending contemporary music alone, which is one of the categories used in those national surveys, about half the population going to festivals, And we know that that's been growing as well. You know, one of the changes that I think's been hinted at here is that while some years ago we might have thought of live music as something, you know, young and subcultural and happening late at night in darkened spaces, and yes, that's part of it and that's wonderful, but one of the reasons we've seen live music attendance and revenue double through the 2010s in Australia is because live music is now recognised as something that's for everyone. And the research does show that across demographics, through age ranges, people do participate and want to participate in live music. And that includes a variety of contexts, including in the daytime, including for families and for children, including outdoors and indoors in large and small spaces.
Well, it's good to keep in mind that diversity, isn't it? Yeah. It'll be fascinating to see what this federal government inquiry into live music comes up with. I'm very grateful to you both for joining us on Life Matters to explore some of the issues involved with it. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Hilary.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Ben Green is a research fellow at the Griffith Centre for Social and Cultural Research. And Charles Jenkins is an Australian musician. His latest album is Radio Sketches the Third.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.